The plane that flew from London to Sunbury, the main airport on the Shetland Islands, was an ATR-42, a twin turboprop, a pretty small commercial plane that only seats 30, run by Logan Air. The entrance to the plane was up a small flight of rickety metal stairs boarding from the tail door of the plane, and I was the last to board, and that was fine because I had the port side seat in the rear, but last on, first off. I asked the young man sitting next to me whether we waited in the plane or had to disembark during our mid-journey stop in Dundee. He had flown the route to Sunbury before. Nah, we stayed in our seats for half an hour while they swabbed out the lavatory in the back of the plane. In Dundee, about half the passengers disembarked, and our steward, Jack, young fair-haired, dressed in a polyester tartan vest and polyester black trousers, double-checked that all the proper luggage left, but ours stayed on the plane. I was tired on the last leg, from Philadelphia to Boston, switching terminals in Heathrow, and almost missing the tiny gate from which this plane left London. We were bussed far from the main tarmac of Heathrow's Terminal 2 to board this plane, as if the Scottish airline, with its fleet of short-flight turboprops, always in some form of financial difficulty, was an afterthought of international traffic. For me, this was the last leg of an 18-year journey. I returned to what anthropologists call the field, and while I've always poked fun at the objectivism of that phrase, as if our desperate lives of labor, politics, and precarity in the American university system weren't itself a field, there was something there, something to this term that marked a different type of journey, required different forms of ritual, attitude, alchemy. 2 months prior, I had flown to Shetland with my son. At that time, we weren't going to the field. We were coming home, as Shetlanders would call it, a place where I would introduce him to old friends in the landscape of Locks, Peat, and Cross, to the bustle of Commercial Street, and the rules of hand waves to oncoming drivers on single-track roads. There were no archives or interviews planned, no research agenda, just rambles with friends, tourist visits to Viking archaeological sites like Jarlsthof, the Cliffs of Aishness, the search for good vegetarian grub for him in cafes and restaurants. But now, sitting in the tail section of the plane, the citrus scent of cleaning wafting from the lavatory, we were about to take off to the field. The sound of an ATR-42 revving engines and pushing full throttle and quickening down the runway is very loud. About 95 decibels in the cabin. I believe in Bernoulli's principle more than I believe in the field. But there is that slight hesitancy as the wheels lift from the tarmac, that blink of dread, where that belief is a kind of faith one has hitched onto, hurtling towards fate. Is that what the field is? That sudden lurch against gravity, that myth-making of theory and discipline? Cultural anthropology, in my case, where with enough acceleration there will be still lift? Does this strain the metaphor too much? Even Bernoulli's principle doesn't really explain lift. Why lower pressure on the top of the wing was caused by faster moving air above than below. My head was starting to bob. I'd been traveling for 22 hours, awake for close to 30, and was finally nodding out amidst the roar of the turboprops and the dread of returning to the field with all its paradoxes of having to make some sense of something to someone, what, to whom, who knows. Certainly nobody in Shetland needed my questions answered. This is the best educated and most literate and generally cosmopolitan place I've ever lived. Since the turn of the 19th to the 20th century, there's been a flourishing of scholarly tradition of historiography and dialect literature, where every detail of the past is combed through in the creation of a present and future Shetland. Over the past 60 years, local government has utilized the proceeds from North Sea oil to hire cadres of technical experts, both locally born and incoming, to administrate, evaluate, constitute Shetland. I was studying up, studying folks who didn't need my questions answered. They could answer their own. An old dog, too tired of chasing his tail for questions or answers. I was drifting, neither asleep nor awake, scattered, inchoate thoughts. The first time I entered the field, I was driving tour buses in Martha's Vineyard, pointing out the homes of the rich and famous behind dense summer foliage, telling stories that were mostly made up about impossible things to see. Only Edgartown was visible from the bus windows, white Greek Revival homes built by shipbuilders and the captains of those whaling ships. The wealth of colonial capitalism on display. The Wampanoag Indians had hunted whales much like Shetlanders did in the 17th century. They used small boats to drive pods onto the beaches to be flayed and butchered by the community. Everything on the carcass used and consumed, the blubber melted down into the precious whale oil that burned so much cleaner than other fuels. By the 18th and 19th century, vineyard folks, both colonizers and Wampanoag, crewed on the whaling schooners that sailed out of New Bedford, Massachusetts. They were the laborers for nascent industrial capitalism, braving the Arctic for sperm whales whose heads were filled with case oil, the perfect lubricant for new industrial factory machinery. These New England fleets were decimated by Confederate forces during the American Civil War. But what really put those who owned those stately mansions out of business was the discovery of petroleum in Pennsylvania in 1859, the discovery of how to refine that tarry sludge into kerosene that burned almost as cleanly, but within two decades would only cost one-tenth the price. For the monstrant, nascent petrocapitalism of 19th century industrial America, the labor costs of whaling were too high for the profit margins. For other laborers, in seemingly other worlds, work and whale oil would persist until the late 1950s and early 1960s. The case oil and melted blubber for lubrications, lamps and soaps, the baleen molded into corset stays and umbrella handles, and the ambergris for perfumes, were products still highly desired in the globalizing economy of the late 19th century through the mid-20th. The maritime skills of Shetland folks, combined with the new technologies of diesel engines, gunpowder-driven harpoons, and steam-powered winches, led young men struggling on the Croft to leave family and seek adventure and better wages off of it. They would ship off on whaling boats owned by the Scottish whaling firm Salveson, leaving Leith Harbor for South Georgia in the freezing South Atlantic, Antarctic territory. Brave and handy crews of mainland Scots, Norwegians, and Shetlanders. The constant improvement of industrial maritime technologies would decimate whale populations throughout the world. And by the 1970s, international regulations set severe limits and restrictions. Now, whale stocks have replenished, and local Shetland skippers hunt whales for tourist photos on summer whale watches. Was I asleep? Had I always been asleep on Shetland? Now, almost asleep in the turbulence right before descending to Sunborough Airport, I smelled the scent of peat. Impossible. Dream nostalgia. When I first lived in Shetland, I burned peats in a Rayburn stove for heat. Often, I'd be chided by the proprietor of the village store that I let the day waste and slept too late. They would track the smoke, the reek coming from my chimney, the lum of the Croft house where I was staying. In those days, so long ago, families worked the hill, digging peats with an L-shaped bladed shovel called tushkers. Long peat bricks set to dry in the late spring and summer, eventually stacked into dikes, and then carted by tractor down the hill to home. Everyone participated. Eventually, cutting peats became mechanized and commercialized, with machines that flayed the land, excreting tubes of peat. People were too busy earning a living to work the hill. There are only a few peat dikes drying during the summer in contemporary Shetland. The smell of burning peat waned as the wealth from North Sea oil flowed throughout the islands. Most of that wealth, of course, was captured by multinational oil corporations and the national government. The local authority, the Shetland Islands Council, lobbied successfully for a tax on oil throughput and has attempted to be future-looking. What happens when oil runs out? A question that's been asked for over half a century. In the booming construction and diversification of Shetland's economy, wages have risen and unemployment, even during the last 40 years of British austerity, is low. The rural landscape is dotted with Scandinavian kit homes heated by oil and electricity. There are still load barriers in the stone Victorian mansions built in what used to be the commercial center of Lerwick. But the harbor is lined with modern buildings to service the highly successful pelagic fishing fleet, an enormous amount of commercial maritime traffic that still services North Sea oil, and now the construction associated with wind farms. I suppose that is the question that I won't live long enough to see answered. How to keep the lights on? The house is heated. In a dreamscape, everything connects. Whaling, peats, oil and wind, drifting forms of energies, whales transformed by death into candles and lanterns, oil and peat transmuted by the alchemy of decay from one form to another, both storing immense amounts of carbon dioxide. Hills that used to have long dikes of drying peats cut from the banks are now carved into by massive digging equipment to make the roads to erect the wind turbines that now dominate the Shetland landscape. All of this disturbance releases more CO2, and there seems to be no easy answer to the externalities when calculating carbon offsets, let alone account for the bloody wars and slavery associated with cobalt and lithium extraction used in the batteries that store wind power before being released to the grid. Everything flows from one state to another as questions. What does it mean to sustain? What does it mean to end? The lurch of the plane hitting tarmac and the sudden braking awoke me from sleep or anxious, ruminating daydreams, I wasn't sure. When I opened my eyes, I saw that the young woman a row ahead of me across the aisle 13C was looking, but not at me. She was smiling at the man sitting next to me. She faced forward, took out her phone to text, and I saw a wedding photo of her in white and the young man beside me, her groom, in a black suit on her phone's lock screen. They were a couple? Why hadn't they asked me to switch seats when we boarded in Heathrow? Why hadn't I noticed earlier and offered? Were there hints? I was the first off the plane, ambling stiffly and slowly, ginger steps down the metal stairs. They passed me, walking from the plane into the Sumber Airport, holding hands, stepping into the future, returning home. I was going to another place, somewhere else. The St. Magnus Street Tapes are a Confabulated Communities production. Produced, written, and narrated by Jonathan Church. Special thanks to the Pixel Bay community, especially Samuel Francis Johnson for musical interludes. The series has been made possible by generous support of Arcadia University, especially Frank and Evelyn Steinrucker.